From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, writer Barbara Gerzudi Harrison talks about her childhood preaching door-to-door as a Jehovah's Witness. Her mother was also a member of the sect. After 13 years, Harrison broke away from the church and went on to lead a passionately unconventional life. Her new memoir is an accidental autobiography. Also, we meet the car lady, Lucille Tregonnen. She has her own car repair clinic on cable and a new guide to what's under the hood. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Senate Whitewater Committee has released its final report. Majority Republicans accuse First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton of impeding the investigation of the late Vincent Foster's office. They also suggest Mrs. Clinton was likely behind the disappearance of her billing records, outlining work for the failed Arkansas savings and loan that's been central to the Whitewater investigation. Committee Chairman Alphonse D'Amato says everyone should read the committee's report.
Whitewater appears to have been neither the beginning nor the end of a pattern of administration misbehavior that should never occur in a free society. Therefore, it is important that the American people have the testimony, read this report, and understand its conclusions.
Democrats have released a dissenting report. They say President and Mrs. Clinton have done nothing wrong and that the report is an election year smear effort. Unabomber suspect Ted Kaczynski is expected to be indicted sometime today in Sacramento, California. He's been jailed in Montana since April, but he hasn't been formally charged in any of the 16 Unabomber attacks. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
Theodore Kaczynski has been held in a county jail in Helena, Montana on explosives possession charges not directly related to the Unabomber case. It's expected he'll be moved soon to a county jail in Sacramento, California, where prosecutors are presenting evidence to a federal grand jury. Federal sources say an indictment could come as early as today. That would be the first charges filed in the 18-year string of bombings that left 23 people injured and 3 dead. Two of the fatal attacks took place in Sacramento, including the last bombing last year. Kaczynski is expected to face explosives and illegal use of the mail charges, which call for the death penalty when the crimes kill. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
Israeli Prime Minister-elect Benjamin Netanyahu today presented his cabinet to the Knesset for approval. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Netanyahu said he's willing to negotiate with all of Israel's Arab neighbors with no preconditions. But his government guidelines also rule out an independent Palestinian state or an Israeli withdrawal from the Golan Heights as Syria demands. Netanyahu said his first responsibility is to keep Israelis safe, and that the Israeli army will have complete freedom of movement. Outgoing Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres also delivered a hard-hitting opposition speech, saying Netanyahu was operating with illusions if he thought Arabs would accept these guidelines. But the biggest surprise of the day came when Netanyahu read a list of his cabinet ministers. Two names were missing: David Levy, widely touted as foreign minister, and Ariel Sharon, who thought he would be housing minister. Frantic negotiations to include the two in the cabinet continue. I'm Linda Gradstein reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 3.5 points at 56.56. This is NPR. The administrator for the Federal Aviation Administration is defending his agency's handling of the ValueJet crash. Administrator David Hinson told morning TV news shows inspectors didn't have proof enough to ground the carrier a month ago. 1 month ago, Hinson told consumers ValueJet was safe to fly. But ValueJet has stopped all its flights for now. The FAA says the voluntary halt is due to ValueJet's serious maintenance problems. ValueJet says it's the target of unfair action. Japan has posted its highest economic growth rate in more than two decades. Government analysts predict Japan is en route to a sustainable recovery. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
For the first quarter of this year, Japan's economy grew at a rate of 3%, outstripping even the most favorable forecasts and giving Japan its strongest growth rate in 23 years. For the 12-month period ending in March, the economy rose more than 2%, ending 3 years of negligible growth. Economic planning officials report that individual consumption has gained momentum and the country is poised for a continued recovery. Financial markets were caught off guard by the impressive growth. The bond market jumped on speculation that signs of the recovery might encourage the central bank to raise interest rates from their record low levels. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
China says its new trade agreement with the United States advances its own interests and does not bow to U.S. demands. The trade agreement averted threatened U.S. sanctions against China. Both sides have wrangled over how to stop Chinese theft of U.S. patented music, films, and software. The chief U.S. negotiator says China gave in on all major demands made by the Clinton administration. Beijing says it will close factories making illegal CDs and start arresting pirates. It has also agreed to open its markets to U.S. film and software. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Penguin Books, publishers of Penguin Classics. For 50 years, the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Barbara Grizzuti Harrison describes her new memoir, An Accidental Autobiography, as an autobiography in which she is not the main character. The essays in the book range from explorations of body image and our culture's obsession with fat to the reflections on her time in North Africa, India, and Guatemala. Grizzuti Harrison weaves her life story in and out of the text, with descriptions of her troubled family, her mother who became a Jehovah's Witness, and her father's bitterness over his wife's religion. Grizzuti Harrison also converted to the sect when she was 9 years old. She remained a member until she was 22. Barbara Grizzuti Harrison has written 5 books of nonfiction, including Italian Days, Off Center, and Visions of Glory. She's also the author of a novel, Foreign Bodies. Her journalistic style has always been intensely personal and self-revelatory, so I asked her why she chose to write a memoir now.
I'm not sure that I chose either to be a personal writer or to write an autobiography. These things somehow evolved, partly, I think, because of something which for years I regretted, and that is not having gone to college. So I never sort of achieved an academic gloss. I never studied writing formally. And I just wrote as it came to me to write. I don't know, strictly speaking, whether this is an autobiography. It's arranged around passions, and it's as much about the passions as it is about myself. I don't know any other way to write. That is, I go into myself, out to the world, into myself, and that forms a whole for me. I don't like saying I was born in September and then I got my first tooth the next year, and then I fell in love. And then, you know what I mean? I don't think that's the way memory works, which is why I call this accidental.
Your first essay is called Breathing Lessons, and the essays are arranged alphabetically. Now, somewhere I read that you do have emphysema.
Yeah. But well, I might have emphysema. I don't know. I have something called... Let me see if I can remember this. COPD, chronic organic pulmonary disease. And for doctors to determine whether it is in fact emphysema would mean very invasive stuff. The simple matter is I can't breathe. And you can probably hear in my voice that there is a kind of slight impediment due to closing off of stuff. So, one could say for shortness and succinctness that I have emphysema, yeah.
The reason I ask is that the word never appears in the essay. And often when I read your essays and reading your accidental autobiography, there's a feeling that things go without a name for a purpose, that somehow naming it would reduce what you're talking about or would rob what you're talking about of its power. And I think it would. But I'm interested what you think of that.
Well, I think this. I think, Barbara, that you are taking the critic's role in it, and I love it, because you're telling me what I did. What I do intuitively and instinctively. And I wasn't aware of not labeling it for any specific purpose. I was aware, however, of kind of regarding it ironically. I mean, I don't want this disease to subsume my whole life. I don't want this disease to be the singular thing people think about me. And I don't want it to be the most important thing I think about myself. And I guess that's why I didn't give it a name. I'm not really even sure what it is. All I know is that there are times when, for the life of me, I can't breathe.
You wrote in your book, Italian Days, you described how you sometimes were short of breath in the hills of Sorrento when you were climbing, and the villagers would stop and ask you, why are you having trouble? And they'd peer into your face, and you wrote that they place no distance between us. When I was young, this lack of space, my family's feeling that they had a right to enter my private world without knocking, made me feel I could not breathe. Reading your essay about the breathing lessons, it makes me think how problematic it is to give illness a name when it exists, for you at least, on so many different dimensions at once.
Yes, how good of you to have figured that out. The fact is that I have often felt suffocated. And how much of this is physical, how much of this is mental, how much of this is experiential, is very hard to know. I used, when I was younger, to sort of write off any notion that that the physical and the psychological work together. And now, of course, I see that is absolutely true now that I've experienced it. And the suffocation, the feeling of suffocation, of course, did stem from terrible stuff in my childhood. And it extends into the present because, for example, I can't put my face in the water when I swim, although water is my favorite element, and swimming is among the three things I like to do best.
I'm speaking with Barbara Grizzuti Harrison. She's a journalist, an essayist, a travel and fiction writer. She's written a memoir called An Accidental Autobiography. You've written a lot about your mother's history and her religion, which was she was a Jehovah's Witness, and it became your religion at a very young age. You've written a lot about it in your essays and in your other books. Did you approach this topic differently as you were writing this book, or did you think of integrating it or glancing upon it in a different way or a different light?
Yeah, I think, as I said, I think in the introduction to this book, there are a lot of different photographs of the same emotional memories. You know, there's a wonderful thing that happens to you when you're writing. It also happens to you when you haunt flea markets, which I do. And that is, what you're looking for comes to hand. You somehow miraculously find that which you need at the very moment you need it. And when I was writing the part about Jehovah's Witnesses, I came across information I hadn't read about Henry Ward Beecher and his wife, who lived in the house I later lived in as a housekeeper for Jehovah's Witnesses. And it did sort of slant it differently. Also, the fact is, as you very well know, Barbara, that 20 years between you and your last writing about something changes you, changes the world, and of course changes your memories. I mean, your memories are always accurate, but they're also always different.
I found it interesting that you write that your father was the source of, at least an accidental source of your mother's conversion, in that he brought a Watchtower pamphlet home one day. Did he ever blame himself for this one accident of destiny?
Oh, I think he did, over and over and over again. He was a very curious man. He was, by curious, I mean he was open to new things, though extremely opinionated. So when he saw this man on the street corner named Mario Cortocchi, as I remember, he bought a watchtower. And when the man said, "May I come to visit you to explain it?" my father, in this respect, at least perfectly guileless, said, "Yes, of course," thinking, "Oh, here's an opportunity for a nice gab and some wine and some smoke and stuff." And then Mario came, and lo and behold, within months, my mother was converted and my father was sort of cast out into the cold.
What in the religion initially appealed to your mother, and is it something you identify with?
My mother was very beautiful, and you know, sometimes I think that when a person is very beautiful, that becomes almost like a character trait, and you can't think of them apart from their beauty. Beauty is a governing factor in the lives of beautiful people. So here she was, extremely beautiful, very passionate, and extremely intelligent, and bound to a narrow, narrow life in Brooklyn, not knowing a way out, not knowing a way to employ her passions, her beauty, or her intelligence. And I think that the Jehovah's Witnesses gave her all of this. It gave her a platform. It allowed her to be admired. When she converted people, she did so with quite incredible passion. And she really kind of smoked with beauty, you know, when she talked about God. And she just was alight with it. And it satisfied her intelligence, although ultimately it destroyed her intelligence because she read nothing but Jehovah's Witnesses material. And, you know, after 3 or 4 years, the world was literally an unknown place to her.
So your mother's religion was a safe place to invest her passion, while men or her husband wasn't?
So she apparently thought. Of course, it wasn't really. I mean, any more than a lobotomy is safe. You know, it had the appearance of being a safe haven. In fact, it destroyed her family. It colored her love for me and turned it into a form of manipulation. It lost for her and her entire family. So, in fact, it put her in very great danger. And it turned her into a kind of odd double personality. When she was busy preaching, she was, as I say, hot and alive with this stuff. When she was a private person, she was more than sullen. She was almost non-existent. She never spoke when she was alone with her family. She reserved it all for her religious passions. And it took some very strange forms. For example, she decided she wasn't going to cook muffins anymore. I mean, all of these decisions, and she wasn't going to cook in aluminum pots. And somehow all of these decisions stemmed, God only knows how, and I do mean that, from her religion.
What was your father doing all this time? How hard was he trying to bring her back?
Not successfully. He had no plan. He thought he could trust in his charm. And he would fight fiercely with her and then suddenly appear at meetings of Jehovah's Witnesses as if the world were all sunny and good. And finally, there was a mutual withdrawal. Till I would say the last 2 decades of their lives, when they just got so used to each other that they came together again, as married people who've been extremely unhappy often do. He cared fiercely that he had lost me. And it showed it in ways that were not always pleasant.
What kind of unpleasant ways?
Well, there were no boundaries. He paid too much attention to me physically. I don't know how to say this. It's hard to say this. He tried to kill me. And I do somehow think that that came out of such an excess of love that it flipped itself around and turned into rage. My mother went out preaching one night, Christmas Eve, and he was so angry and drunk that he took he took a washcloth from the sink and tried to throttle me. I just don't know how to say that without making it sound like an interesting anecdote. I think it has something to do with my breathing, actually.
Was it an isolated incident, or did it fit a pattern?
That was an isolated incident, but his physical demonstrativeness, I can hear myself stuttering as I talk about this, his physical demonstrativeness was not. He liked to see me naked. I, on occasion, saw him masturbate. He never, in words, said anything much. Nor was this a physical consummation. I mean, I was never penetrated by him. And it's odd I'm avoiding the word abuse. I don't know why I'm avoiding the word abuse. It's still very raw. And it happened. And now I want to say it doesn't matter. I don't know whether it matters or not. He's dead. I don't miss him.
Barbara Grizzuti Harrison is my guest. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Back with writer Barbara Gerzudi Harrison. Her memoir is an accidental autobiography.
You were indoctrinated into the Jehovah's Witnesses when you were 9, which seems really, really, really young. It's hard for me to imagine a 9-year-old taking part and taking control over their own conversion or their own religious destiny.
Well, that's an interesting question, whether one does or not. I mean, it makes one think, doesn't it, of people like the Freemen in Montana. How many of those children are committed to what those adults are committed to? At a time when the official hierarchy wanted to excommunicate me, which was certainly an act of redundancy. I mean, I had left the religion, maybe 15 years before when they came in full force and said, now we're going to excommunicate you, which they call disfellowshipping. And they asked me whether when I was 10 and symbolized my dedication to the Witnesses by water baptism, I had known what I was doing. And I said, well, how does a 10-year-old know whether she knows? I thought I knew. I don't know. Do you know I don't know the answer to that question. It seemed authentic to me at the time. But, of course, I was operating on so many things, on wanting my mother's approval, on sort of thinking this was kind of glamorous, this whole idea of a new and different religion. And also, really, in a belief in faith in God that was at odds with the actual teachings of the religion. It was very, if I sound confused, it's because it was very confusing.
As a child witness, what were your responsibilities? Were you supposed to go out and convert?
You got it.
This starts that young?
Yeah, I rang doorbells. I went from door to door and sold literature. Actually, they don't sell it. They place it for a contribution, which is a distinction without a difference. And I had, you know, little homilies, little sermons worked up. And sometimes people were very kind, and sometimes people were very amused, and sometimes people were scary and dangerous. And I think the Witnesses must have thought that precisely because I was young, I could sort of get away with anything. So they would do things for which even now I find them unforgivable. For example, if a crazy lady joined the sect, I mean a visibly crazy lady, you know, somebody with her hair 10 feet in the air and bees in it or something, or, you know, somebody's eyes were rolling around in their sockets, they'd put her with me in the door-to-door work. So the adults were relieved of her presence and I was stuck with it. And it was literally dangerous, you know. I mean, I rang doorbells in very strange parts of town. And it beats me now how they could have left any kid so unprotected.
Don't they give training lessons? I mean, before they send you out with a bunch of encyclopedias, they give you a training workshop.
Yeah, they sort of do. I mean, there was a Thursday night course we took called the Theocratic Ministry School. And it was the same if you were 60 or if you were 9. You know, you rang a doorbell. You knew what book to present. You had a sort of small little thing to say about it. And then you were on your own. And I must say that the being alone was terrifying to me. When I think of it now, I can hardly bear the thought of going to a door alone. I still find it difficult to walk up to a door alone.
I'm having a little trouble, and I understand this isn't good, that I have trouble keeping a timeline in this story.
Okay.
But while all of this was going on that you're describing, you were also in love, or both of you were in love with each other, in love with your English teacher, who was definitely not a Jehovah's Witness. And that must have been utter blasphemy in the eyes of the church.
In
spades. Who knew about it, and did they try to discipline you?
All good questions. Let me start by reminding you what you already know, which is that when Dante saw Beatrice was 9, and that was a real love affair, and so was Romeo and Juliet. I was 15, and I fell in love with my teacher, Arnold Horowitz, who died 30 years ago, and whom I still remember practically daily. Who knew about it? Well, he and I knew about it. We loved each other very much. This love did not take sexual form. It was all quite mysterious. I mean, I had grown up with mysteries, the mystery of the relationship of my mother and father, the mysteries inherent in this religion. I was used to sort of dwelling in mystery. So I never quite knew what his love meant. I only knew that it existed. I told the president of the Watchtower Society when I finally went to live at headquarters building about this relationship. And he told me, of course, that I could never see Arnold, which is exactly what I knew he would tell me. And, of course, I knew that I wasn't going to obey. And I remember thinking, well, God can't kill Arnold. Why would God want to kill Arnold? Why would Arnold be swimming in his own blood at Armageddon, which I was obliged to believe? So Arnold, simply by being, as well as by arguing with me endlessly, took me out of the religion and saved me. And I am grateful to him forever.
He tried to get you to go to college, which was against the teachings,
yes.
against the rules of the
and
Jehovah's
still
Witnesses.
Is. Still is.
And did you come close?
Yes. He had me take, at that time, the University of Chicago under, perhaps you'll help me remember the name of the guy who ran it. Was it Hutchinson? In any case, it was a progressive educator, allowed admittance to people of any age provided they passed a series of tests. So when I was 15, Arnold asked me if I'd take the tests. Yes, I said. I passed the tests, which would have meant that I could have gone to the University of Chicago when I was 15, but I didn't. And I remember telling him, I only said I'd take the tests. I didn't say I'd go. And he cried. And he was also in a rage, just a rage that my life was being circumscribed in this terrible way. He also, however, lived to see me leave the sect. He didn't live to see me write my first article or short story, and that makes me sad.
You write that when you finally left the sect, he cried, though. He said, now you'll be just like everyone else. And I imagine that must have been your fear, too.
No, it was never my fear. I was so happy when I finally, you know, leaving was not an overnight process. It was an extremely difficult process. And I think I had what might generically be described as a nervous breakdown on my way out. But I understand his crying. For one thing, I think that he thought his own use would be limited. You know, he wasn't going to take my hand and take me into the future. He wasn't going to marry me. He never married anybody. And it was true that he had found such intense, blank sadness in the world himself that he saw that for me, too. And so he cried because I would have nothing to buoy me. But I don't think it's true that there's nothing to buoy me. I think his tears were misplaced. And I truly hope he's in heaven understanding that now.
My guest is Barbara Grizzuti-Harrison. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Barbara Grizzuti-Harrison. After she left her troubled family and the Jehovah's Witness sect, she discovered a world of freedom and sensuality. She has a new memoir and some car talk with the car lady, Lucille Tregonhaun.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. I've been talking with writer Barbara Gazzuti Harrison about her new memoir, An Accidental Autobiography. Her mother was a Jehovah's Witness. Gazzuti Harrison converted as a child and left the sect when she was 22. I asked her what life was like once she broke away.
The first big surprise was that people were nice. I mean, one of the things I was told from the time I was 9 until the time I was 22 was that the world was full of evil, terrible people, and they were all going to hurt me, and then God would get his back. I sort of had a glimmering going from door to door that there were lots of kind people, and I certainly knew that Arnold was a loving man. But the wonderful thing was that when I finally left, and when I left home, because being under my mother's roof was stifling, the kindness of people came again and again with, you know, wave after wave of surprise, wave after wave of kindness. And that moored me, and it was an exciting time. I lived in the East Village, wasn't called that then yet. I started going to jazz clubs. I had friends. I was free to read anything I wanted. I used to set my clock at 3 in the morning so I could go to a kosher restaurant called Ratner's on 2nd Avenue and have blintzes. I mean, that freedom for me was having a cherry blintz at 3 o'clock in the morning.
You met the other, what you describe as the other love of your life at a jazz club around this time, and you refer to him in your writings in this book and elsewhere as Jazz Man, which I'd like to ask you about later.
Okay.
How did you meet him?
I went to a club called Minton's, which I hear rumors Bob De Niro may reopen, and I hope he does. Bob, if you're listening, do. Minton's was on 128th Street in Harlem. I don't know how I knew that I was attracted to jazz. I simply don't know how I knew that. And I went to Minton's to see a clarinetist called Tony Scott, and Jazzman was, I'm not going to say what one of his sidemen, I'm not going to say what instrument he played, but because I do want to protect his identity. But Jazzman played with Tony Scott, and I took one look and said, uh-oh, there goes my virginity. I also said hallelujah.
That relationship lasted three years.
3 years. He was married. He was and is black. He was and is a jazz musician. It's interesting, isn't it? I had no sense of sinning. None at all. Because my love for him was so overwhelming that it seemed to eradicate any idea I might have had that this was immoral. And to this day, I don't think it was.
It's funny to read what you have to say about him, what you omit and what you include. And it's hard to get a picture of a man called Jazz Man. He seems to be very unlike you, but you meet him on this very intense, passionately physical and also spiritual plane. And you write in other parts of your book about your intuition or your prescience, really. Is this how you understand your relationship?
Perhaps this might make it clearer for you. I have told him that he may not read this book. And the reason is that I wrote it in the part about him in rage and pain, which of course coexist with love often. We broke up. I mean, this has been going on for 35 years in one form or another. And it gave him no trouble at all that he was not to read the book. He said, I haven't read a book in 20 years anyway. Why should I read this one? So you're quite right. We're different. It doesn't matter. We love each other. I don't know how to explain that except by saying stuff that's going to sound gooey, which is, I do believe that he is the other half of me. He's necessary for my life, and I to his. And beyond that, there is no explanation except that we laugh a lot together. We understand each other on a level that has nothing to do with words, which, by the way, I consider heresy when I hear anybody else say.
Well, this first part of this relationship that you're describing happened, what, 34, 35 years
ago? Yeah, about 35 years ago. Yeah.
And you fairly recently got together again.
We did, yes.
Did you reunite or meet each other back as you were then? And how long did it last?
He'd been trying to reach me, and I'd been fending him off, knowing that I would be plunged into this kind of intensity that I no longer thought I wanted. I mean, I, after all, had been married, had two children, had a whole life. And then, for reasons that are totally unclear to me, I decided I had to see him again. This, by the way, may, it occurs to me now, have been a kind of preparation for writing this book. Not in a calculated way, because it's never occurred to me until this very moment that that may be why I needed to see him again. I reached him, I saw him, and it was as if we, after 30 years, had taken up from the day before, or more appropriately, the night before.
I think this is, many people have this fantasy that you would reunite and re-find the one love of your life. Did it play itself out as a fantasy?
You know, I'm a blabber, I'm sorry to say. And so I told all my friends about this. We talked for a long time on the phone before we actually were able to meet. And everybody said, you're setting yourself up for a fall. Well, in one sense, I was. I fell in love again, if indeed that love ever went away. I think you always love the people you always love, you know? Yes, can I say I entered the fantasy or I entered real life? I don't know which he is, but he became as much a part of my life as he had when I was 22 and young and pretty and all that other stuff. I mean, he's an old guy now, too, you know? I'm an old broad and he's an old guy. The book ends with our having parted, and yet again, and if I say perhaps we should leave it at that, you will know, of course, what I mean, that we got together again, not to put too fine a point on it.
You mentioned you were married shortly after your relationship 35 years ago with Jazzman ended. You married a man you always refer to in your writings as Mr. Harrison.
Mm.
That's impersonal enough. And you write about this marriage even here in this memoir, which is pretty personal, as if you were asleep most of the time. I think blinded is the word
I
you
was.
Use.
Numbed. I was totally numbed out. Here's a kind of a demonstration of it. We lived in India, in Libya, in Guatemala. It strikes me as the oddest thing in the world that all that time I never bought a guidebook. I never saw things in an organized way, or indeed in any way at all. I mean, I wasn't seeing. I couldn't allow myself to see. I think once you tell yourself a basic lie, like I love my husband being the basic lie, you're unable to enter the real world of truth at any given point. What returned me to truth and to some degree of personal honor, of course, was the existence of my children. And again, I mean, they would not like to hear this, or perhaps they would. They are also the saviors of my life.
Well, you left your husband. You had these two children and no career. What plan did you have for survival?
No. I believed in my luck. This is what I did. I reviewed books for Publishers Weekly, which is the trade magazine, as you know, for the publishing trade. And that meant that I read 7 books in their unfinished state every week and made $70. And with a slight contribution from Mr. Harrison, I raised the children. I was determined to do something that would keep me at home with them, because I like to be the one making the brownies, you know. I wanted to be the mommy on the block that was home and the other kids could come home too. I don't believe that time with one's children is about quality. I think quantity counts. I think they need your physical presence. And I made my life around that principle. And I became a writer because I finally found something I could write about that seemed important to me. And I owe that to the women's movement.
And what you found to write about was your...
My kids went to a school that, a very progressive school, where they were taught how to be happy, didn't always catch, and they were also, but they weren't taught how to spell. If I had to do it again, I'd send them to a school where they learned Latin and Greek. But in any case, this very well-meaning school was racially and economically integrated, and a bunch of us mothers, black and white, got together to discuss the burgeoning women's movement and to see whether the curriculum did satisfy the needs of our daughters. It was very revelatory and helpful in our racial relationships. I don't know quite how helpful it was to our children. But I wrote an account of this for the New Republic, and I never stopped writing thereafter.
I have to ask you this. I'm thinking that Jazz Man, your lover, once said to you that you can't let anything rest. And I wonder, after finishing this book, whether you do or have put anything to rest.
Yeah, well, of course he meant I was a pain in the neck. And he meant that I never let anything alone and that I restlessly probed and dug. We've come to peace with that, by the way. For one thing, I want him to talk about his life into a tape recorder because it's a valuable life. Have I let anything rest? I will tell you this. The next book I write will not have the pronoun I in it once. This is it. From now, next time I'm going to write about a Scottish murderess or about capital punishment or about Frank Sinatra, but I will not write about myself.
I will try and hold you to that. Well, Barbara Gazzuti-Harrison, thank you very much for joining me on Fresh Air.
Thank you, Barbara.
Barbara Gazzuti-Harrison's memoir is an accidental autobiography. Coming up, we talk with the car lady, Lucille Tregonnell. This is Fresh Air. Imagine you take your car into the shop and ask for the most experienced mechanic. A few minutes later, out comes a grandmotherly-looking woman with blondish hair swept up in an immaculate French twist. You'd do a double take. Lucille Tregonnell has been dealing with double takes for 23 years, since she first opened her own auto repair shop, Transmissions by Lucille. A divorced mother of three children in the early 60s, Tregonnell worked as a clerk in a car repair garage and discovered her calling. Now she owns two car repair businesses, hosts a cable TV show about car repair on the Home and Garden television network, and is the author of the new book, Lucille's Car Care. Unlike most car buffs, Lucille Tregonnell had very little to do with cars until later in life.
At the time that I was driving, it was, as a young person at home with my father's cars where I had no access to the repairs on them. And then I went away at college and I met and married a Pittsburgher and moved to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And at that time I drove, very little. And I can remember, one car that we had early in the marriage that no one could fix, but it wasn't a case of fraud. It was a matter of trying to find someone who knew how to take care of the problem. And it was actually that peculiar little quirk that got me sort of involved in the industry, because someone had recommended a specific auto repair shop where they had a man in there who would surely be able to fix that. And I went down there and was very relieved to find that a job, this happened to be an electrical problem, that I had been quoted maybe hundreds of dollars to rewire the whole car, he was able to fix in about 15 minutes' time while I waited. So I was very much impressed with this mechanic. And later on, when I was looking for part-time work, and the only experience I'd ever had working had been doing some clerical work in a Buick agency while my husband finished college, I went back to that same mechanic and asked about, doing some bookkeeping or that sort of thing, and happened to hit there on a day when he had just lost someone to do that. And so I started doing some part-time work by picking up the material and taking it home and returning it. And then when he enlarged the shop, I worked part-time in that shop. And at the time that that I was finally facing the fact that I was splitting up with my husband, he was looking for someone to go to work full-time. And simply as a matter of convenience, I decided to work there full-time. And that was the beginning of something, that never ended.
I think that we think of ourselves in the 90s as no longer having these preconceived ideas about what jobs are appropriate for women and what jobs are appropriate for men. But it seems to me if there are any last bastions of supreme sexism, it would be a car repair shop. Do you still deal with that kind of prejudice?
Well, yes, we do some. And I think you're absolutely right. This is one of the last places. And certainly we get some questions. I have one young woman that works for me who especially gets upset for when she's dealing so competently with someone with all the information they could possibly want. And they keep saying, let me talk to a mechanic. I need to talk to a man. And can actually get very rude. But we have a way of handling that in my shop. And what we do is if someone comes in and insists that I'd like to talk to a mechanic, well, sir, I can help you. And if they go on, I must talk to a man, that instead of arguing with them and getting the customer really angry, we'll call one of the men from the shop, the dirtiest and hopefully the dumbest, if we get that combination, and have him come in and say, sir, here's a gentleman you can talk to. And so the customer will look at the technician, ask him a question. He, in turn, will look back at the woman to get the information because he doesn't do any scheduling. He doesn't know anything about prices. And so he will ask the woman then and repeat it to the male customer. And after a couple of questions, the customer will almost always turn to the woman and talk to her directly. And that way we've gotten our point across, and sometimes you get kind of an embarrassed look on the man's face. But in the end, he will talk to the woman.
That's quite a skit you've worked out.
But it works. It works because if you keep insisting, sir, I can help you, I will tell you what you need to know, but please, I'd really rather talk to a man. Then what you do is anger the person to such an extent that they're not going to be a customer anyway. And once they see that the information that they need will come from you, whether through a man or not, why, it works.
On the other side of this whole issue, are you still shocked by how many women don't know how to check the oil in their car or change a tire?
Well, I think it's getting better. And the thing that's interesting that happens is that now I think it's just about the same whether you're a man or a woman on how much you know about the car. Because, for many years, young men grew up learning about cars from their fathers because men used to do a lot of the maintenance and just generally learned more about their cars, and boys helped, and so that you always had this difference between what a girl knew about a car and what a boy knew about a car. But now, with the changes in our society where not many people do the maintenance on their cars and fathers don't work with sons as much anymore, and I think with women becoming more independent, many of them make an intense effort now because they own a car to learn more about it, that I find just as many men that come into the shop, especially young men, who have no conception at all about the operation of the automobile.
So either we're all getting more ignorant, or women.
No, well,
are catching
I think
up.
It's a change. It's a balancing act where there are fewer men that know very much about cars. There are more women that do. So it's just about even now.
Let me reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Lucille Tregonnen. For 23 years, she's been the owner and chief diagnostic mechanic for Transmissions by Lucille, a chain of two car repair shops in Pittsburgh. She's written a book about car repair called Lucille's Car Care. And Lucille Tregonnen also hosts the cable show Lucille's Car Care Clinic on the Home and Garden television network. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with auto mechanic, or as she prefers to call it, automotive diagnostician, Lucille Tregonnen. Did I say that right?
That's
automotive
correct.
Diagnostician?
Right.
Now, way before you ever dreamed of being a car mechanic, you worked in an auto repair shop, first as a clerical help. Were
right.
people always asking you for advice about their cars, just desperate for anybody who knows something?
Yeah, that happened, and especially when I was the only person that they talked to when they first came into the shop. And this was an expanding repair business, and the owner would say, I'll be back in a few minutes, and maybe not show up for an hour or two. So I found myself faced with that awkward position of handling people and trying to explain things to them when you didn't understand. So I started studying manuals so that I could at least fake it and talk as if I knew what I was doing to make it a little bit easier through that period. And then once I got started, I was thoroughly fascinated.
When you opened your own garage in 1973, did you know the look then that you were going for? How your
yes.
garage should look compared to your average Joe body shop?
That's right. And one of the reasons that I came up with that name, Transmissions by Lucille, is I was looking for something that would set it aside as being a little higher level, a little more upscale. And I thought that sounded like a designer dress, you know, Transmissions by Lucille.
It sounds like a diner.
And I, you know, wanted to be, you know, well equipped and keep the shops clean and orderly and, you know, everything just looked like some place that you would feel very comfortable coming into.
Why Transmissions?
Well, that's where I got my real fascination, because when I first got exposed to the industry, I was in the shop there where we did general repair work and engine tune-ups and everything. But the transmission is so different from the rest of the car. It's like a complete system all by itself. And you tool up differently, you train differently. It's one of those kind parts of the car where you can take something apart and everything looks perfect, but it doesn't work properly. It's, you know, it's like playing, you know, this tremendous Nintendo game, looking for the solution to this problem. And I just find the whole automatic transmission system as extremely fascinating and more interesting than any other part of the car.
Was there ever a point where the chauvinism that you did encounter just got you down and you felt like getting out of the whole business?
Well, in the early days, before I was in my own business, because, you know, I don't know if I've lost any business because of being a woman, because if you don't want to deal with a woman, why would you go to a shop called Transmissions by Lucille, you know? So I don't, you know, most of the people that come to my shop are pretty decent. But in the early days, in the 60s, there were times when I became, you know, very defensive. I was going to do it or else. And I remember one time having rebuilt a carburetor, which is kind of an intricate little device. And I was so proud of myself that the car worked perfectly. And when the people picked up the car, I was warned, don't tell them that you did that carburetor because they're going on a trip and they'll worry. And I was totally miffed. I was so proud that that carburetor, the whole car ran so beautifully after that. And I was, you know, I wanted the people to know that I had done it. But I kept quiet, sort of against my will, because I didn't want them worrying that they would break down because a woman had done it. But that always stuck in my mind as how unfair.
Did you ever tell them?
No, I never told them. I never told them. I collected for the job and just kept my mouth shut, and they didn't have any problem with it.
You mentioned that cars are getting more complex and more computerized. They have more computerized systems. Do you think it's making us all more car repair illiterate, that we just throw up our hands in despair over mastering this?
Yes, and I think it's made it almost impossible to do many repairs for yourself. And so your only hope is to understand and learn about them enough that you'll know when to take them to the shop and you'd be able to deal with the repair service on them. But right now, they manufacture far more computers for cars than for any other reason, for any offices or anything else. There are more computers manufactured for cars. It's become just absolutely insane.
Is that what is driving up the cost of car repair? It seems so insanely expensive when you take your car in.
Yes. It's much more difficult to diagnose the problems, although they've got lots of equipment out there now where the car can actually tell you, you know, where it hurts. But some of those systems, the repairs do become expensive. The only difference is that they don't break down as much. There are fewer repairs necessary for many of them. But if you have a problem, then it's costly.
So what do you advise people? Do you buy a car that's less computerized and more and not as automated?
Well, now that's becoming almost impossible because every type of car has gotten there. And, you know, in the future, it gets more and more, high tech, so that you can't avoid buying them. You can just maintain them properly, do everything you can, you know, to keep them working well, and then find yourself a really good repair shop, when you need it.
Well, I really enjoyed talking with you. Thanks, Lucille Tregonone, for coming
on Fresh
Air.
It's been great.
Lucille Tregonone's book is Lucille's Car Care. She's the owner and chief diagnostic mechanic of Transmissions by Lucille. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Fred Landrell. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Phoebe Vanskoy is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from William Morrow, publisher of Kenneth C. Davis's new book, Don't Know Much About the Civil War, Everything You Need to Know About America's Greatest Conflict But Never Learned. This is NPR, National Public Radio.